All right, well, last week we got through only the last part of chapter 25, and as you probably recall, we had both the introduction of the twins, right? And they were fraternal twins, as we saw from that family photo album that we had last week. And it's kind of interesting that that was the first focus as the genealogy. Then we saw some things about kind of family dysfunction, parental particularism or favoritism, and I know none of us parents have ever had that happen in our house at one time or another, but we see kind of all the difficulty that comes out of that. Now as we move into chapter 26, what we're going to see is really the only chapter that is fully devoted to Isaac. Now we learned a lot and saw a lot about Isaac in the Abraham narrative. So we learned a bit about his character and his faith and his patience and his piety. But this is kind of the only, not kind of, it is the only chapter that exclusively speaks to this patriarch in the string of patriarchs. And with this recorded life is in many ways a recapitulation of Abraham's life. So if you look at the events of 26, it basically just is kind of a, you know, one-to-one reflection and almost the same order of some of the things and features we saw in Abraham's life, which I think is kind of a reminder to us that the ways of man don't change, and thankfully, nor do the ways of God. But we've got a whole book on that, right? The book of Ecclesiastes that talks about vanity, vanity. It's all vanities. So it seems that this poor guy, Isaac, is wedged into the story between Abraham and Jacob. And as one commentator says it, I think, fairly well, Isaac seems to be the ordinary son of a great father and the ordinary father of a great son. So it's almost like he's a bridge from Abraham to Jacob, but he is no less a patriarch, just less prominent. And that's a principle we're all going to see, right, in the millennium, right, as we come back. I do. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. So we'll come back, and, you know, we'll be no less saved in the millennium. But there's a little thing called rewards, right? And we're going to all have jobs as we come back here and serve in the thousand-year millennium. And so some of us might be head greenskeepers. Some of us might be the head pro. And some of us might be just out there cutting the grass. I'll be happy with any of those jobs because we'll be in heaven. I know who's going to get the pine cone picking up job because she is outstanding at it. Although we had a funny story this week, little Emma, maybe you know Colin Jordan's daughter, came up to me during the week, and she's here when Kristen's here and she's homeschooled. And she said, "Pastor Steve, I need to talk to you." Said, "Okay, Emma." She says, "There's a lady that every week puts her trash on your yard, and I don't know who that is." And I said, "Whoa, really? Who does she look?" "Well, she has short hair." And I said, "Well, that's Miss Mary. So she's cleaning up. So you were the subject of conversation this week." It was cute. It was really cute. Okay, so Genesis 25, 19 to 34 is actually chronologically prospective, meaning it's looking ahead, and 26 is retrospective. So in simpler words, 25, 19 to 34, the events of that look ahead and occur before the events of Genesis 26, which looks back. Now, the reason for the inverted order is simply the authorial emphasis, okay? The author wants to emphasize the issue with the twins, particularly introducing them, and the prophecy regarding the twins in chapter 25, and that'll really set us up and prepare us for what we're going to begin to see in chapter 27. Okay, but now in chapter 26, he's going to come back and just give us some historical reflection on the life of Isaac. Now, we can prove this. How would we prove that chronologically this is happening before chapter 26? Is there anything in chapter 26? And Jim, you can't answer because you got ahead of it up there that last week.
The fact that when they went to Abimelech and was my sister, and what took her, if the twins had been born, if she'd been
Very, very insightful. Right, so as we get to chapter 6, and we look at 6 to 9, and we see Isaac pull the same move as his father, right? She's my sister, right? Now, that ruse couldn't have worked very well if there were little ones running around, would it?
No.
So obviously the text actually can support the assertion, okay? So we see that in chapter 26, verses 69. So again, why the order? I kind of already said that. And the idea is to introduce Jacob and to prepare us for what follows in verse 27. And we've seen this before in the Bible, and frequently we see this idea of kind of a summary, and then we get more detail about things later. So we're kind of getting this summary introduction. So this poor Isaac seems to be kind of almost a footnote acting as a bridge, but we don't feel too bad for him. He was a patriarch. He did live the longest, and he probably had the easiest life of the three patriarchs that are recorded in the book of Genesis. Now, the structure of the chapter is kind of, I've organized it into what I call six little vignettes or six little stories, okay? So we kind of see six reflections of key events in the life of Isaac. The first is in verses 1 to 5, where we see a covenant reaffirmation, and that's part one. We're going to see a part two of that. The second one is in verses 6 to 11. We're going to see like father, like son, okay? Isaac pulling the same moves as his father did. Verses 12 to 14, God's going to bless Isaac, just as he did bless Abraham after his folly. And verses 15 to 22, he's going to run into trouble with the locals, okay? Part two of covenant reaffirmation in verses 23 and 25. And then finally, a peace treaty in the land, before we get these last two verses in the chapter that speak to Esau's fateful marriages. So you can see it's pretty clear in the text, six little kind of reflections, and for whatever reason, this is what the author wants us to remember and be recorded about his life. So someone's get us started here by reading verses 1 to 5 of chapter 26, please.
Now there was a famine in the land. Famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars in heaven of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws."
Okay, thank you, Danae. All right, so we have this kind of focus here is covenant reaffirmation. So as we see the beginning here of the recorded events of Isaac's life, we see God once again coming back and affirming the covenant that he made with Abraham. Now, verse 1 sets the table, okay, the summary for what comes behind it. And we're told again that there's a famine in the land, and the author is very particular to say another famine from the one in the time of Abraham. Now, scholars that want to make a big deal like this is all borrowed stuff say, see, it's the same story, they're using it twice and so forth. Well, I don't think so. I think whoever wrote this, we know who that was, Moses, inspired by the Holy Spirit, knew that silly ideas would come up back that. What does it say right here? Now there was a famine in the land, right? And what does it say? Besides the previous one. Okay, so about 80 years have elapsed between the past famine and this famine. And the name Abimelech is just a title for Philistine kings. Okay, so it's not the same man, likely, as the one we saw before. Now, in verses 2 to 4, God appears to Isaac for the first of two times that are recorded in this chapter. And God commands Isaac to stay in the land. Basically says, don't go down to Egypt. Now, whether he was sojourning and on his way and God stopped him, or whether God's just reinforcing, don't go any further, we're not really told. But the point is, he says, don't leave the land. In other words, don't go down to Egypt like your father had done before you. And then he reaffirms the covenant blessings in verse 3a and the covenant promises in verses 3b and 4. And I'm going to keep harping on this difference between blessings and promises, and I'll explain it as we get there. So the oath that is referred to is the one that was made back in chapter 22. So remember, after Abraham had fulfilled God's test of sacrificing Isaac, and he didn't withhold him, that God said, I'm going to swear and give you blessings. And so that's the blessing they're referring back to. And clearly Isaac would have understood that because he was there. He would have heard that. This third instance again, anybody got a King James version out there or a New King James? So read 3 and 4 for me again, Doug.
Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father. And I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed.
Okay, so King James, and actually New King James, makes it even clearer. We encounter this word again. Remember, we've talked about this word, zerah, a few times. It's a collective word. It only has a singular form, and based upon context, you decide whether it is plural or singular. So in the first two instances, context, I think, clearly tells us he's talking about descendants, plural, in terms of offspring. And then we get to this last instance of it, and it's particularly descendant, or seed, if you will, referring again to the seed that's ultimately going to come, or the messianic promise. Okay, so we've seen this pattern over and over again in these chapters, and the author is very clear to make a distinction between the masses and the particular one who's going to be the source of ultimate blessing to all the nations. Now, we remember from Abraham, and this is the point I want to make about blessings and promises, that God's promises are unilateral, okay? In the Abrahamic covenant, it was a one-way, unilateral, non-conditional covenant. God is going to fulfill each and every aspect of that covenant. And he has to, because if he doesn't, then what would we have to say about God? He's not God. He lies. Okay? And that's not a kind of God that I think we want to be following. So the promises are unilateral, okay? The blessings, however, remember, this is the extent to which you enjoy the promises is conditioned upon behavior. Now, John takes this up in his letters, and he talks about it in the context of fellowship and sin. And what he says is that our fellowship with the Lord is impacted when we're sinful, right? And that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, every one of us with children has understood when those little loved ones are not quite as obedient as we want. We still love them, but our fellowship is probably a little different. Sometimes we have to bring out the disciplinary device, right? Otherwise, probably wouldn't do that today. You'd be in trouble or in jail somewhere. Maybe just one of those, but you may even be in trouble in jail for that these days. But the fact of the matter is, the degree to which we can enjoy the full extent of how God wants to bless us is indeed conditioned upon our obedience to him and his commandments. We can't expect to be living in persistent sin of any type and expect that God's going to be blessing us. Okay? It's just inconsistent with his character. It doesn't mean that we're not being blessed, because we're blessed when he doesn't just kill us and take us home.
Amen.
Right? And we had to struggle with that at the end of 1 John last week. What is the sin unto death? But the fact of the matter is that we have his common grace, and the world has God's common grace in every way, but we have a particular grace in that. Now, we come to this verse 5, which I say, for me, was enigmatic the first time I read it. And I couldn't really figure out what was going on. So what is going on here in this verse 5? Let me read it again. It starts with this conjunction, because. So we're going to get a reason for God's blessing. It says, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So what's going on here in this verse 5? What's happening? Doug.
I'll take a shot. I think he's making it apparent that Abraham believed God, walked by faith,
mm-hmm.
trusted God. He wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
But his life was one that just gave evidence of his trust in the Lord.
Okay. Yeah, I think you get it. I'll show you how I get to the thing.
The justification of why the seed is going to come through the family?
Not that, but you're close to another idea too in that, and I have to give credit to Jim back here who added it when I got to this part of it last week. But yeah, there are kind of two ideas here. So the challenging part is not the first two things, right? Abraham obeyed me. We saw that, right? What was the character of Abraham's obedience?
His giving of his son.
Well, other than that, but I mean, when God told Abraham to do something, what did he do?
He did it.
And how quickly did he do it?
Right away.
Okay, so he was obedient, right? So he did, in fact, obey God, and he kept God's charge, right? So God's charge would have been what he told him to do. But the part that kind of stumbled me for a bit was my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. He didn't have the statutes and the commandments and the laws. And I think Doug's kind of got to the idea here, okay? So he did keep God's charge. He was obedient. And in his obedience, he believed and was declared righteous, and he was demonstrating the obedience of faith, okay? And this is really what Doug just said. He's demonstrating the obedience of faith. And really, it's faith intuitively obeys. What were you going to say? You're going to go to Romans, yeah, okay. So
Paul says to bring about the obedience of faith.
Yeah, right. So just go to Romans for a second here and look at chapter 2. You know, we have this great doctrinal treatise here from Paul. And in chapter 2, in verses 14 and 15, Paul says this about the Gentiles. Well, starting at 12, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For, okay, explanation, when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or defending them. Okay, so essentially, our consciences are always alert to the scenario. So Abraham, in being obedient, had this intuitive obedience of faith. So he was intuitively doing what would become the law and spelled out as the law, and indeed this is what's going on. Now there's one other interesting thing that's going on, and those of you that may or may not know Jim, who's normally at the North Campus, but I guess he decided to come down here and hang out with his age group or something. I don't know. A bit tired of hanging out with those young kids up there. But glad to have you with us. But he mentioned this idea, which I think is actually correct. There's also some aspect and suggestion of imputation here, right? So he's giving him all these blessings. Why? Well, because of what? The work of Abraham. Okay, so we see kind of this idea, theological idea of imputation here as well. His obedience is being imputed in some sense to Isaac as he's passing on the blessings to him. Now, I don't think it's a full-on explanation of the doctrine here, but we see kind of this idea of passing it on. You look quizzical here. Okay.
I'll wrestle with that one.
You wrestle with that one. Okay. And we can wrestle about it later, and if I can't answer it, I'll send you to Jim over here. But the fact of the matter is that I think it is a good insight. There is some aspect here of the kind of idea that things are passed on. We've certainly seen that before. We see that in the great doctrines of Christ and his righteousness being imputed to us and our sin being imputed to him. But the idea here of kind of the work of a father, the work of the sons and so forth, there's a family connection here that we can see.
Well, obviously, Isaac saw his father's faith when he put him on the altar and was ready to, what better example of trusting the Lord do we all have in the
Well, that's one, and I'd also have to say that Isaac was pretty faithful too.
Yeah, that's because what I mean, he
was strong enough to pop his pop and get out of the way, but he didn't. So he certainly exercised a great faith, and those two pinnacles of faith right there.
You wouldn't have a son with that kind of faith if he
Right, didn't have a father that was modeling that and right. teaching those things. And then, of course, as Paul ably notes in his treatise, his little Reader's Digest of Romans and Galatians, that law and promise are not in conflict with one another, okay? They serve different functions, right? The law leads us to our sinfulness. The promise leads us to the solution and the process. So they're not in conflict. All right, verses 6 to 11. Somebody pick those up, please.
And Isaac called in Gerar. Gerar or Gerar?
Gerar. Hard G.
And the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, "She is my sister." For he feared to say, "She is my wife." Lest, said he, "the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon." And it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. And Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, of a surety she is thy wife. And how saidest thou, she is my sister?" And Isaac said unto him, "Because I said, lest I die for her." And Abimelech said, "What is this thou hast done unto us? One of the people might likely have lain with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us." And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, "He that touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death."
Okay, well, like father, like son, right? So here we see at the outset, there is an interesting note that I would say is just how quickly sin follows on the heels of blessing. Okay, now we don't know chronologically if these things happen right after another, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, right after we've been blessed, we are so prone to go right back to sinning again, and here we go, okay? So quickly sin follows. Can you think of a recent New Testament example we've had where we've had kind of a great faith followed by a great failure? You got it, right? Peter, what did he do? "Who am I? Who do you say that I am?" "Ah, you are the Christ."
Three times.
Right, he answers the right and most important question, right? Now, what's he do right after that? "Get behind me, Satan." Right? So, you know, it's just in our DNA, unfortunately, right? So Isaac calls a play from dad's playbook, right? Though it's a Tishmor egregious. Why is his, you know, misrepresentation a little worse than his father's?
She wasn't really his sister.
Right. Well, was she? Exactly right, okay? She wasn't a sister. At least Sarah was a half-sister, okay? Rebecca is his cousin, all right? So he's stretching it even a little further. He says, "Hey, worked with pops, maybe I'll try it myself," okay? But he's stretching it quite a bit further, all right, which is where we get kissing cousins from, right? Did you know that term came from the Bible? Yeah, so next time somebody talks about kissing cousins, you can get right into a gospel conversation with them, right? Okay, so that aside. And the other reason it's more egregious is Isaac had seen how God had protected his father, right? So the idea is, what was he thinking? And you women ask us that all the time. And what's our answer all the time?
"I don't know."
"I wasn't." I love it. You guys know human nature. Okay, that's always our get out of jail free card. "I wasn't. I'm not supposed to think. You're supposed to do the thinking." Okay, so he had seen how his father had been protected. So, you know, it is more egregious, I think, in terms of, you know, I'm not going to put it on a monster scale, but we do see that he kind of keeps there. Now, reminding us, I think, that sin is just not logical, right? I mean, think about it. Think of all the stupid things you've done, right? Now, it doesn't take me very long because there's only one or two I've ever done in my life. But I got to say, each time I think of the two times it happened, none of them were logical, right? It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense until we understand the real issue, which is our hearts, right? So Isaac's fears don't materialize, yet he persists in the deception, right? His fears don't materialize, right? So why should he have changed course by now? He should have changed course. Why?
We just got God's affirmation,
right?
His blessing and his encouragement,
right?
With
yeah.
You.
Yeah, but just stick to the text here. Let's just take a look at verse 8. What's it say?
"It came about when he had been there a long time that Amalek, the king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife."
Okay, what's the key part of that verse there? It came about what?
A long time.
So he'd been there a while, and nothing had happened, right? He could have broken off this scenario. Doug's translation actually is pretty good. The word there is the same root verb as his name, to laugh. So the idea that he was laughing with her or sporting with her is really what was going on, in that they were showing signs of affection towards one another, as you would expect in a happy married couple, okay? So obviously he'd been there a long time and nothing had happened, okay? So he certainly could have changed course at this point in time. But Abimelech catches him sporting, as it says, with Rebekah, which I said as a minute ago is a word play. It's the participial form of his name, okay? So he's, you know, the sport is sporting with his wife, is how you might, or the laugher is laughing with his wife, is how you might literally translate that if you were looking at the Hebrew. And, yeah, I'm sorry, Diane.
Well, every time I read this account, and even back with the father, Abraham, both of them put their wives in jeopardy.
Mm. We'll get to that.
They were not safe from other men.
Right. So, John's looking pretty good, isn't he?
Yes.
Is that the moral of that story? We'll get to that. It's a good observation. It's absolutely a good observation. Okay, so, to her point, what's wrong with his response? Well, clearly, one of the things is, right, that he puts her in harm's way, right? But not only her, what else? The blessing, the purity of the seed. Same mistake his father makes, okay? Okay, what else do we see? What else is wrong with his response?
It's a lack of faith.
Yeah, lack of faith, okay? Just like his father, he assumes the worst about Abimelech without cause, right? So he's assuming they're going to do it. He's exposed Rebekah and the seed line. He's acted in a cowardly manner. So I'll put a sharper spin on Diane's comment. Yeah, he was a complete coward, right? And he has no apparent contrition. He's like, oh yeah, you know, I thought you're going to kill me. She's just a throwaway, right? There's just no contrition in his. Yeah, Jack.
Well, yeah, if you take this literally, if he had gone to Abimelech and said, that's my wife, Abimelech's response to him was, it suggests that Abimelech would have respected that.
Right.
And said, hands off.
Yeah, exactly. Right, and you raised my next point, which is Abimelech gives him a well-deserved tongue-lashing, and just to the question, what's interesting about his further actions, he has more integrity, as Jack just noted, and more morality than the promised seed line. Now, you know, it seems this Abimelech probably did a better job of learning from his father, right, than Isaac did learning from his father, right? He saw what his father went through, you know, sees a strange guy go up. He probably knows it's the son, right? So he has a lot more integrity. So yeah, I think Jack's exactly right. I mean, we see a great deal more integrity from a pagan king than we see from God's promised people. Now look, we see it around us all the time, right? I gotta say, you know, you take the Mormon faith, I mean, they're good people. I mean, they don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't do whatever, they don't do this, they don't do that. And, but they're a long, long ways from the Lord. What'd you say?
They just have six wives.
Yeah, yeah.
Six wives.
And what's wrong with that? That's both expensive and stupid. Yeah, so it is. I mean, but seriously, I mean, you can look at a lot of good people in the world, right? And there are a lot of good people. Yeah, Betty.
I look at myself and I say, this is the fear of man. And how many times do I compromise my own stand, my own faith, to fit in with the crowd? To,
right.
You know, to seek the approval of man.
We don't
have to look to the Mormons. We should look in our own heart and see, you know, where we compromise for the fear of man.
Yeah, Bobby?
Satan always tries to thwart God's plan.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
Well, this is just trying to corrupt that seed.
Same thing. You know, Satan loves the church, by the way. You know, he loves all these secret churches and all these other places because they love it. Yeah, they're coming. They're far away. Yeah, Jim.
There seems to be some discernment on the part of Abimelech. I was reading this text other than men might well have slept with your wife, you would have brought guilt upon us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're talking about a culture there that probably didn't have too high a moral standard.
Right.
And he was saying, if we had done this, you'd have brought guilt on us.
Yeah.
He apparently had some recognition there that
Sure. Well, or you just go right back to conscience again. Go back to that Romans 2, 14, 15 passage again,
well,
right?
Here's a pagan culture. I mean, he's talking about bringing guilt.
Yeah.
But sleeping with some other man's wife there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, why would he all of a sudden say that? Because probably it happened all the time.
Yeah, probably did. So he's got some discernment, as you said. I think Betty's comment is really a good one, this idea that we have this fear of man. I mean, it happens all the time. You think of verses like... you know, if God's for you, then who can be against you, right? So why don't we remember that? But yet when the moment comes, right, we're quivering and this and that. And, yeah, fear of man's a big deal, right? And it happens all the time. We see it.
So easy to get sucked in, you know, when I go out with my neighbors and they start talking about this person, talking about that person, making off-color jokes.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to get sucked into that because of the desire to want to fit in with the crowd.
Sure.
Instead of...
Well, yeah, it's it, and it's such a hard line, right? I mean, so we're called to be in the world, right? Not of the world. And you're called to be relational with people, to share the gospel and so forth. But if you're always saying, it's a bad word. I mean, you know, there's this kind of line between, you know, what's fear of man and what's kind of discerning prudence in terms of how do you create relationship. And again, I think it's where the church makes mistakes today, because what does the church try to do?
Fit in.
Be more like the culture, right? What good is that? But yeah, it's still a hard thing. I mean, you've got to kind of, you know, and I remember my former friends when I first became a believer, they didn't know how to talk. You know, they got every kind of expletive coming out of their mouth, and they're like, and like, just talk. It's okay, I heard the words before. But, you know, the idea of, you know, how it changes. But, again, I think just kind of your witness, if nothing else, just your unwillingness to partake, mm-hmm. right? Just you can still be there and be kind, try to steer the conversation in a different direction. I mean, there's lots of things we can do, but it is hard.
You
and so this
on guard.
Yeah.
So it's so easy to just go the, you know.
Yeah. You know, John ends his first letter. It's kind of this cryptic last little verse after everything he's done. He says, you know, my little children, flee from or guard yourself against idols. And so what's an idol? It's just anything that's not God. And so it's, you know, you've got to flee from that. You've got to guard yourself. You can go to James 4:7, you know, what are the problems? You know, you're warring with your desires. It's, you know, it's not all just the world. It's also our desires in our heart as well, right? To be loved and liked and appreciated and things of that nature. So he has a measure of integrity, as Jack has noted. Nevertheless, he recognizes adultery is wrong, guilt, just as Jim said. And so ironically here, we have a pagan king that seems to have a better sense of morality than God's chosen individual. Okay, he acts to uphold the morality too, right? So it's not just kind of like a moral speech, right? What does he do? He sends out an edict and says, no tachi, right? Don't touch these guys, okay? If anybody does, you're going to certainly die. You shall surely die. You shall die a death. Okay, it really is emphatic in the Hebrew.
Before.
What's that?
I said we heard that once before.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. Okay, somebody read verses 12, 14.
Now Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him.
Okay, so, as with his father, despite his failures, God bestows divine favor on Isaac, right? He just kind of fouled up, but yet God comes in, and he gives him this stupendous crop. Now, that's kind of ironic, right? Because how does this section kick off? There's a famine, and now he's got a crop that's a hundredfold. Right? Okay, well, that's a lot of beans. Okay? That's a lot of beans. So, riches upon riches is what it actually said. So, God has added to the considerable possessions he's already inherited from Abraham. And he was so rich that he started to attract the envy of the locals, right? So, I'm not sure that I could read into this that Isaac is flaunting this in any way. But clearly, he is so wealthy that it stands out quite significantly to the locals. So, verses 15 to 22.
Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells, which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, and they had filled them in with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." Then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called him. Also Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also, so he called its name Sitnah. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he called its name Rehoboth, because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land."
Okay, now, having stirred up their envy, right, the locals start to cause trouble, striking where it hurts, right? You got to remember, this is arid land, right? You got lots of flocks, you want to have lots of water. So they're going around stopping up the wells. This leads to then a formal request in verse 16, where Abimelech says, "Hey, enough's enough, you're too powerful for us, get out." Okay, so before he'd welcomed him, now he says, "Get out." Now, what's interesting about Isaac's reply? What's interesting about his response?
He
yeah, and what, why is that interesting?
Because he's expecting, he's respecting the authority.
Okay, that's one idea, but what makes it ironic?
God promised him that this would be his land.
Well, that's right, but the simple solution here is he's got the power to say no. Why are they asking him to leave? Because you're more powerful than us. Okay, so he is demonstrating, I think, an interesting New Testament biblical quality. What is it? Jesus was considered, think of the Beatitudes.
Passive.
Passive, that's kind of the idea, but it's different. It's a different biblical word for it.
Humble.
What's that?
Humble.
Humble.
Meek.
Meek. There we go. Got it. Meekness. Okay.
Meekness.
Meekness. All right. He's showing power under control. Okay. So meekness is not wimpy. Meekness is rather power under control. Okay. So he's demonstrating discernment. He could have caused a stink. Obviously, he was powerful enough because that's why they wanted him out. But he responds with meekness. So we see a good biblical quality in him. So we do see positive qualities about Isaac, okay? We do see kind of his basic character. But he doesn't go far. He settles in the Valley of Gerar. So basically, he's moved out of the big city into the burbs, okay? He hasn't moved completely out of the territory, where he has a series of conflicts over wells in verses 18 to 20, right? Now, what's going on other than the obvious in these verses? Why is he having these conflicts over the wells? A little tough one.
Well, they stopped him up.
Yeah.
You know, that his father dug them, Abraham dug the well.
Yeah.
And they stopped him up because I don't think they want him there.
Yeah, okay.
So there's but he reopens them.
Okay.
He begins, you know, I love that verse. He dug again the wells of his father.
Right.
You say, well, let's not look too deep into these things.
Yeah.
You know, Abraham's faith is great.
Right.
Demonstrated his life.
Right.
And I think Isaac, as he's getting pushed out here,
mm-hmm.
begins to look to God more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And so he begins to travel in the same path his father did.
Okay.
Open it up.
Yeah.
You know,
so that's true. You got an idea, Bobby?
Just what he's saying, that God is saying, not here. Not here.
Okay. Now that's slightly different, and I think you're actually dead right. Okay. It isn't so much them, it's God. It's where's God trying to get him? Right? He's pushing him back to where he wants to be. So he's acting a bit like a prodigal, if you will. And God is using these situations to get him back. What did he say at the beginning? Don't go down to Egypt. Okay? He wants him back in the land. Okay? So yeah, I think he's using those. He wants him back. He uses the conflict to keep him moving in the right direction.
If we could all think that way.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll have that rhetorical question, right, when we get to the end here. Yeah, so, you know, the idea is, where's God trying to get you back to, right, as you're seeing things happening in your life? So after several attempts, God finally has Isaac where he wants him, right, and the opposition ceases, right? So recognizing God's providence, Isaac acknowledged that God has made room for him and his flocks in this place called Rehoboth. Again, it means make large or make wide. So again, he is exhibiting the faith of his father Abraham as well, in that he recognizes God's hand in these various different things. So God has brought him back to that spot. Okay, verses 23 and 25. 25.
And went up from there to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee, and will bless thee, and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he built an altar there, and called upon the name of the Lord, and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants digged the well.
Okay, so having settled his herdsmen, Isaac moves back to Beersheba. That's kind of base camp, if you will, right? This is where a lot of stuff has gone on. Whereupon, Yahweh makes his second appearance. Okay, so I said he appeared to Isaac twice in the narrative. He indicates his approval of Isaac's actions by immediately appearing to him again. So what's the substance then of Yahweh's blessing? What's the substance here of the blessing? Right, that's one. What else?
That God's with him.
Yeah, okay. I think that's the big one, okay? Don't fear, man, I'm with you. You think of New Testament verses for that, right? I'm going to bless you. I think that's right also. Multiply your descendants. Again, why? What's it say? For the sake of Abraham.
Okay. Chosen family.
Okay, for the sake of Abraham. So have no fear, for I'm with Abraham now, and I'll be with you again. So we see this idea of afterlife again. Right? Doesn't say I was with, I am with Abraham. Okay, current, present tense. The blessings and many descendants are reaffirmed, okay, as Lisa noted. And this, what is the basis of the blessing? And I already said, his original promises to Abraham, signaling this idea of covenant continuity, right? So the covenant is going to be lasting. It's unilateral. It's going to be passing through, okay? It's as valid today to the Jewish people as it was 2,000 years ago. God is going to honor the full extent of the Abrahamic covenant. Praise the Lord, though, we're in what? A pause. And the pause is to what? Gather in the Gentiles. Okay, and then as Paul says in Romans, he's going to return to them and then graft them back in. Okay, so we see God's working there. So like his father, Isaac responds with worship. He builds an altar, sets up his tent and digs a well. All right. Last section here, verses 26 to 33.
Then Amalek came to him from Gera with his advisor Ahuzzath and Phicol, the commander of the army. Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, since you hated me and have sent me away from you?" They said, "We see plainly that the Lord has been with you." So we said, "Let there now be an oath between us, and even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." Then he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. In the morning they arose early and exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away, and they departed. departed from him in peace. Now it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, We have found water. So he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city was Beersheba to this day.
Okay. All right. So covenant reaffirmation here, again, followed by this peace in the land. So the final vignette, again, parallels completely the story with Abraham, right? Remember, Abraham was approached by the former Abimelech for a peace treaty in the land. And like their fathers before them, both men recognized the value of peaceful coexistence. All right, so they realize there's value in having this. Now, he approaches Isaac with his group, his retinue, and Isaac is puzzled, or he's toying with him, I don't know which, right? What's he say? Hey, you kicked me out. What are you coming here for? What do you want, right? So why are you here? You kicked me out. At a minimum, he's establishing their ill will towards him, okay? It's kind of hard to tell. Abimelech expresses the same motivation as his father had, and that is he recognizes that God is with him, right? So good guy to have a treaty with. So what's disingenuous about Abimelech's response? What's not quite genuine in his response to the question? Right. Okay. Yeah. He ignores what must have been known as the harassing on the way out, right? So he kind of overlooks that part, which in fairness, he may not have known, but more likely he's taking diplomatic license, right? He's putting the best spin on the deal that he can and just kind of overlooking that fact. And you see it all the time, right? I mean, we see it today in the world. You know, we see our own government and other governments kind of like, oh yeah, we haven't done anything to you. So it's not an unusual thing. But Isaac the meek chooses to respond by not responding, okay? Basically, he sees no value in needlessly quarreling about it. He overlooks it and chooses to just go ahead and accept the response. Now, instead, he signals his agreement by preparing a covenant feast. Okay, so anytime you're going to do a treaty, they would have had a feast to memorialize the treaty. And he follows by the formal ratification and bidding them farewell the next morning. So again, he's right back to the same place where his father was when he'd gotten done with the Abimelechs. There's peace in the land. Isaac is back squarely in the land where God wants him. Okay, and that's the way it ends. So shortly thereafter, perhaps as a sign of God's providence, they dig another well. It yields water. He names it Sheba. That's that same word, Sheva, that we heard all the way back before. It could mean either oath or it could mean sevens. So it's the well of the oath or the well of the sevens. And Be'er is well. So the well of Sheba, they're just memorializing the location. It's the same spot. And they're memorializing the name to this day. And to this day, Beersheba does exist, okay? So we see those things happening in the process. So regardless of the reason, the place is perpetually known as Beersheba. Last two verses. Okay, so now we're kind of getting transitioned back, right? So back to family matters again, right? And we're informed here at the close of the thing. Before moving on, we get this final expression kind of Esau's character, and it'll kind of prepare us for what's happening next, right? He goes out on his own, and he takes these two Hittite wives. Now, a couple things wrong with that, obviously. He's marrying into the Canaanites, number one. Number two, he doesn't approach his father to arrange a marriage for him. So we kind of see his independent nature, and we see him kind of really eschewing all spiritual concern, right? So in the chapter before, what did he give the birthright up for?
Stew.
A bowl of stew, right? Okay, so he doesn't put much stock in the promises and the birthright. And now he goes ahead and marries a couple of local gals, okay? So again, not showing much concern for the spiritual purity and the things, or any much respect for his father and his mother. And we're told that this results in grief, literally bitterness of spirit, to Isaac and Rebekah. Okay, we're going to come back and see that again. Rebekah's going to use this as we get to the end of chapter 27 in a rather clever way. She's a clever gal. But it does remind us, right, some kids are just a little bit more troublesome than other kids, right? But we got to persist in parenting. We have to persist in what we do in the process. Okay, so this is the things of Esau. Kind of a, well, let me just one other thing. Just jumping ahead, the only other thing we see about Isaac again, so just flip ahead to chapter 35. So basically, you know, he'll be mentioned in 27, but the only other time we see anything more about him is chapter 35, and then in verses 28 and 29. So Jacob came to his father Isaac in Mamre at Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. So we're going to see a lot of brotherly stress here until we get to this point. But at this point, at the time he died, the two boys had reconciled, and there wasn't the animosity between them that chapter 27 is going to create. And from here, then, the exploit of the story really centers on Jacob. So Isaac lived to 180 years old, and through some dating gymnastics, his actual death was about another 12 or 13 years after this recorded point. I'm not going to get into the details other than to say he died at 180 years old, and we mark this full transition to Jacob. He was buried, the two sons Esau and Jacob, signaling their reconciliation, which will make sense after next week's lesson. Okay? So, closing thoughts here, and then I want to just quickly introduce chapter 27, because I want you to read ahead and think about something. So Isaac succeeds and fails in pretty much the same fashion as his father, right? We see kind of the repeated patterns reminding us that parents and grandparents, the kids are watching, okay? The kids are watching us. God was intent upon returning Isaac to the land, and I think this gets to Betty's question or Betty's comment here. You know, what is it that God's doing to get you home? Right? So we think about things that are happening in our lives. They're not happening randomly, right? They're happening for a purpose. And I suspect if it's something that's not the happiest time in your life, it may be something where God's trying to get your attention. He's trying to get you home, right? Focused on him, him on the throne, idols moved out, desires pushed aside, and God will use circumstances of our lives. I know we probably all have stories that we can relate to where we look back and we see how God has used circumstances in our lives to get us where he wants us to be. Though Isaac was imperfect, he was still God's man. Okay, so God was not ashamed to be his God. Okay, and God used Isaac to pass on the covenant promises. I don't know about you, but that's reassuring. Right? God can use broken vessels. He can use dirty pots, right? He's still our God and is willing to call us his friend. So it's reassuring to us that God can work with these broken and imperfect vessels. And in fact, that's all he's got to work with, right? Broken and imperfect vessels. But again, we see him accomplishing his purposes, which is just, to me, magnificent, but amazing when you think about what he does when he gets through that. Okay? So that's the life and times of Isaac. I just want to introduce chapter 27 to you, 2 minutes here, because I want to leave you with a question. So this is really the way of man is deceit. Okay? We're just going to see deceit after deceit after deceit as we kind of move through this chapter. It's a vivid illustration of Jeremiah's appraisal of the human heart. We'll go back and look at that next week. But what does Jeremiah say about the heart? It is desperately wicked. Who can know it? God. Okay? So we're going to see that played out. None of the characters in the narrative rightfully elicit much sympathy. It's amazing when you tell the story and you think about people, how some will have this great sympathy for Esau. Really? And then, oh, we're just being sympathetic to Jacob. Really? And then Isaac, he's just kind of letting it all happen around him. And Rebekah, she's planning and plotting. Nobody really looks good in this chapter. Okay, Jack.
You see that little quality of reconciliation when Isaac and Ishmael cut together at the end.
Yep.
And Jacob and Esau get together.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so you see how God brings things back together, right? Exactly right. So you see the reconciliation. You can see kind of really bad behavior, but we do see through God's intervention and the events and everything that happens, these brothers do come back together. So not too many sympathetic figures. The chapter is just loaded with irony. I mean, it's just loaded with it. So Jacob and Rebekah scheme to acquire what God's already promised. Okay, that's number one. Isaac attempts to give away what God's already taken away, the birthright, right? So Isaac's scheming to do what he wants. Esau moans or mourns losing something he already gave away, right? He gave the birthright away. Nobody twisted his arm. He made an oath, right? Both Isaac and Esau compromised themselves for a hot dog, right? You know, he wanted a bowl of stew. Isaac wanted one last savory game meal, right? So I guess both men were men of their stomachs. And the man of spiritual fortitude, Isaac, because remember, he is a pretty high spiritual giant in my eyes as we come out of the Abraham narrative, kind of declines in his life, both physically and spiritually, to the end period of his life, which tells us that, you know, what does it say? Work out your in fear and trembling, right? So it's not something we get to stop working on. As soon as we start coasting, we're going to start coasting into trouble in the process. And we see that with him. So here's what I want you to think about. Read ahead in chapter 7. And given all this, what is the major idea that we should grasp as we read the chapter? Kind of what's the big point that we see as we move through chapter 27? Okay, so that's your homework. Read it, think about it, and see what we have to say. Okay? Ken, would you close us up in a word of prayer, please?
Heavenly Father, we just praise you and thank you for your word, Father, for how it teaches us, how it makes us look at our own